face. I need a shower. Concern lines Aker's face, but he stands to give me space. I'll be on the roof. Take all the time you need. I wait until he's gone before I get on my knees and dig out the tin basket I keep all my old sketchbooks in from under my bed. They're labeled by the age I was when I received the sketchbook, and I sort through them until I find the one I'm looking for. I unbind the twine holding year 14 together and flip through the pages in search of the drawing, a specific drawing of Kai. Past the pages of fish and boats and trees, all of them as dull and lifeless as the ones before. I stop when I find what I seek. My first sketch of a human. Of Kai. A handful of us had spent the day scaling a broken and fractured husk of a tree that stands a ways from the grove. We'd repeatedly climbed to the lowest limb that could support all of us, leaping from its height and into the ocean, 30 feet or so below. Kai had convinced me to stay, to sit on the limb and watch the sunset while everyone else swam back to the grove. It was a good day. I remember being happy. No. Content. But it all changed with one touch of his hand on mine. My stomach was in knots as we watched the sun sink lower and lower over the horizon. I was seeing him in a different light. His hair and cheeks and nose and lips were something to really look at. I tried not to stare, but failed. He caught me sneaking glances and didn't bother hiding the smile tugging at his lips. And he kissed me. Just at the corner of my mouth, as chaste as a kiss can be. All my drawings prior to this were of nature or random objects, but never of people. Too intimidated by the challenging proportions and emotion human faces display. But after that day, I was determined to figure it out. My strokes were too heavy and lifeless, the brows too large and eyes too small. I run my fingers over the terrible drawing, hating my tears as they fall onto the image, smearing the charcoal. For the first time since I was 7, I cry and cry and cry. Chapter 14. On the morning of my matching ceremony, I should be getting ready, fretting over my hair, painting my eyelashes with lacquer, dealing with pre-ceremony jitters. Instead, I'm watching another man twirl a blade. Lying on the floor beside my bed, with one arm folded behind his head as a pillow, Aker's eyes are trained on the twirling blade balanced on his middle finger. It defies logic, the blade spinning upright, its point somehow not digging into the pad of his finger. He was there when I awoke hours ago, and we've been lying in the quiet ever since. Him doing magic tricks with the weapon, and me going through my old sketchbooks. Most of them are terrible, but a few catch me by surprise. Not this one, though. I had tried to draw an animal from one of our textbooks, a horse, and I think I added an extra leg. I slap the sketchbook shut and turn my attention to Aker. What is your gift, exactly? He looks up at me, the blade remaining atop his finger.
I'm what they call an elemental. There's many kinds, but I'm able to wield anything with metals. Iron, steel, brass.
He tosses the blade and catches it in his palm, holding it out for me to take. I reach for it and run a thumb over the point, nicking myself. A wry smile pulls at his lips. Sucking the blood from the pad of my thumb, I give him a look. He's done well not being a snarky asshole all morning. No need to ruin it now. His growing smile seems to reflect my internal musings. Tell me. I run a finger over the initial inscribed on the hilt. I dare a look at him, gaining courage from the openness in his eyes. Tell me everything you can. He nods once, turning his attention to the ceiling.
Your family were visiting my family in Kenta when you went missing. We were at our southern cottage by the ocean, and you weren't in your bed when your mother went to wake you. After scouring the coast and surrounding woods, they suspected you'd snuck out to see the ocean on your own.
A pinch of worry creases between his brows. You were there, I say, realizing he's recounting his own memories.
I was,
he says, glancing at me.
I had just turned 9 and was tasked with finding water elementals in town to help search the sea. The few we found worked together to push the tide back, searching for your body.
Foolish hope swirls inside me.
My parents? I inquire, unable to finish the question. The worry of memory in his gaze smooths into a tender sort of joy.
Your mother is alive.
Something between a hiccup and a gasp escapes my mouth, and I hurry to cover it with my palm.
She took your disappearance the hardest. There have been whispers and claims of sightings of you over the years, rumors about neighboring territories taking you. She sent century after century to hunt down any information they could find, but they never came up with anything substantial. Your father thought a funeral would help her come to terms with the loss, but she never gave up hope. I'm currently unsure of your father's whereabouts.
There's sorrow in his gaze. It's strange to look into his eyes and see pain reflected back at me. We knew each other, I say in understanding. He nods. We were close. I clarify further. He nods again. Friends, even? A small smile overtakes his lips.
If you can believe it.
I shake my head. I can't. He chuckles, eyes crinkling at the corners. Is that how you recognized me at the market? He tilts his head to the side.
It was your blade.
I've been curious as to why he had it strapped to his person that day in the market, but haven't had the guts to inquire about it.
It calls to you, as you do to it.
I turn it in my fingers, looking at the cracks and divots with new eyes. Is it magic? Grinning, he sits up, leaning sideways against the bed so he can see the knife in my hands more clearly.
You made that blade with your father's help, he says. He wanted you to be comfortable with a weapon early, and it's seen as a rite of passage for children to forge their first blade by hand, so they have an appreciation for the skill and effort it takes to make them.
I try to conjure an image of my father, but nothing emerges from the recesses of my mind.
Whenever a weapon or tool is handmade from the hearthstone of the land, it is magicked to its maker. Axes or swords or even a battering ram. Whatever it is will always answer the call of the person who made it. It's why most blacksmiths are blood-oathed. Only the most righteous are trusted to forge for others.
Where's yours?
Sitting in pieces on my mantle at home, if I recall correctly. Splintered in half on a walnut not long after my 11th birthday.
He holds out his palm, pointing to the scar between his thumb and forefinger. How did you end up with mine?
Your mother gave it to me when I joined the army, to have during my travels. It hummed when I saw you in the market.
His eyes hold mine, searching for something in the depths that I'm unable to see.
I looked for you. In every market and podunk town, in every corner of every land, I searched each face for yours.
I'm without breath. Without words, really. Overcome with an unnamed emotion, I bite my tongue out of fear of saying anything at all. He swallows and lets his eyes fall to the floor, but I get the sense it's more to give me reprieve than it is for his benefit.
And I had quit looking. It became harder to convince myself you were still alive as the years went by, and instead I wore the blade in honor of your memory, having long since given up hope that it would lead me to you. That's why I couldn't believe it was you when the blade signaled your presence. Even when I saw you with my own eyes, like a ghost in broad daylight, I refused to believe it. Because,
he trails off, looking up at me.
Because it meant I gave up on you.
His shame is palpable. It sends a sharp pain through my chest. For the friend I didn't get a chance to grow older with, or for having no way to appease his guilt, I'm not sure. I quickly remind myself that he falsely accused me of thievery and threatened to take my hand as payment. He's still Kenta, still a soldier of a ruler who exiled an entire population of people just because of one person's deeds, assuming everything Iker has told me is true. I hand the blade back to him, both to give him a distraction from his shameful thoughts and simply because I like watching him play with it. So, I say, balancing my chin on my hand. What's my title? He lifts a brow.
Thinking a little highly of yourself, aren't you?
I roll my eyes. The Alaha wouldn't breach enemy lines to steal a child of a commoner. He smiles, all teeth and pretentiousness.
You are Princess Jovi of the Melee. I laugh. No, really. What am I?
He doesn't blink.
The Melee have been ruled by your family for the last century, longer than mine have ruled in Kenta, even.
My smile falls away when he doesn't smile back. You're serious.
Deadly.
He answers. I flop back on the bed, at a loss for words. Melee. Melee. Not Alaha or Kenta, but Melee, and a princess at that.
I don't understand. Why would Ren kidnap me? For what? It started a war. There was a lot of finger-pointing, many accusations thrown around. It's probably exactly what Ren was aiming for, to cause infighting between the remaining territories in hopes that he could pick off the weakest and commandeer their land.
Well, it obviously didn't work.
Morning light filters in through the curtain of the window, causing streaks of gold across his shoulders and hair, highlighting the russet in his eyes. They shine up at me.
I'm starting to wonder if it's more sinister than that.
I roll onto my side and face him.
What do you mean? You know about Alaha's matching ceremony,
he says, eyeing me.
But a true love match isn't chosen. It's gifted, just like your magic.
Aker's gaze flickers as he considers his next words.
A true match is rare, a bond like no other. If Kai was able to convince you that you are his match, he could claim half your Melee territory.
I don't understand, but I would have found out his motives once we were on land, surely.
What you've been exposed to here is a fraction of what it would be at full power on land.
He makes a face like he already regrets what he's about to reveal.
And his magic becomes more potent through physical connection.
He says, voice tense.
Touching. Skin to skin. Or, as you probably know, mouth to mouth.
I hold a hand up to stop him from continuing. I get it.
By the time you found out who you really are and what they've done, you wouldn't care. The person you are would cease to exist outside of what Kai influences you to think or feel.
Doubt lingers in the back of my mind. The idea that I could lose all sense of self, all sense of free will by someone else's hand, magical abilities or not.
Aker stands abruptly. Someone's coming.
It's probably the breakfast Kai is having delivered. He's unmoving, head tilted. Listening for what? I'm not sure, considering he's attempting to hear through walls. What? He reaches for the blade and shoves the hilt into my hand, motioning for me to be quiet with a finger over his lips before pointing at the ceiling. A knock sounds at the door. I glance in its direction, then back toward Aker, but he's already disappearing through the window. I shove my legs into a pair of pants and slide the blade into the back of my waistband before covering it with my tunic. Taking a deep breath, I unlatch the door and open it.
Fallon,
I say, unable to hide my shock.
Good morning,
she says, beaming.
I wanted to bring your dress.
She raises an arm draped in fabric.
Can I come in?
A guard stands behind her, looking bored.
Sure,
I say, fully aware I can't deny her entry. Her dress flows around her ankles as she breezes past me, hair in intricate plaits with flowers woven throughout. She takes in my small abode, eyes lingering on my bed, the washbin, and the toilet in the corner. I would have once been humiliated in the face of her perusal, but I keep my chin held high when she finally meets my stare.
Today's the big day,
she says, masking her acuity.
How are you feeling?
I blow out a breath. Sick to my stomach? She smiles, the epitome of understanding and kindness.
That's normal. Kai misplaced his sword twice this morning.
There's a beat of awkwardness when I don't reply. The mention of Kai reminds me of the open wound beating inside my chest.
There's no need to be nervous. The day will go by fast and you two will be together by sundown.
I nod. This is awkward on so many levels.
Anyway,
she says, placing the gown on the bed. She tugs and pinches at the fabric to prevent wrinkling.
I also wanted a moment to speak with you.
We sit on the edge of my bed with the dress between us.
She tries to tuck a hair behind her ear, even though she doesn't have a single flyaway, and I realize she's the one who's nervous. I don't know if you remember when your parents died, but there was a time you came and lived with the captain and me. I nod, a slow dip of my head. I remember. You were inconsolable. Day and night, I held you in my arms as you cried, trying and failing to give you some semblance of comfort. That was, until Kai took a liking to you. A soft smile pulls at her lips. We'd kept you apart, not wanting to overwhelm you. Kai was a bit of a hellion at that age, but he managed to escape his father's eye and came into our room one night when I was attempting to get you to rest. He saw you and somehow knew to be gentle. He was so quiet as he crept closer to get a look. You locked eyes with each other, and it was the first time you quit crying in weeks. Tears form in her eyes. From that point on, you two were inseparable. I swallow past the lump in my throat. She dabs under her eyes with a finger. I'm going to be a sobbing mess today, aren't I? Reaching over, I place a hand over hers. Thank you. I'm not sure what I'm thanking her for, but it feels appropriate at the moment. She squeezes my hand between hers. I should let you get ready for the ceremony. I've stood to escort her out when an idea occurs to me. Before you go, I say, holding the door open, can I ask you a favor? She's taken aback, but smiles. Of course! It's a little embarrassing, but the gift you give your match after the ceremony, I haven't received my official pay as a guard yet. Say no more, she says, cutting me off. Digging into the coin purse hanging from her hip, she deposits a handful of coins. I manage not to gawk at the number of gold and silver in the mix, and she winks at me before walking away. In the time it takes me to shut and latch the door, Aker is back in my room. He eyes the dress on my bed, gaze swinging to me. It really is a pretty dress, the nicest I've ever owned. I suppose that's what I could have been thanking Fallon for. I toss it on the floor. We'll wait for the matching ceremony to start, then we'll sneak away in one of the fishing boats. It's the only time that part of the docks won't be guarded. Aker smiles, but it's straight filth when he says,
Shame. I was kind of looking forward to tying you up.
Chapter 15. I wait for as long as I can, but the bird never comes. He's been scarce since Aker's arrival. I leave a bowl of dried cheese and nuts out for him anyway. It won't last more than a meal, but it's all I have to offer as goodbye. I climb back through my window and into my room for the last time. Aker finishes refilling the water skin, eyeing me as he stuffs it into my bag. Music drifts up on the wind, signaling the beginning of the ceremony. Aker asks, Now? I nod. But first, I pull the oldest sketchbook from the stack by the bed and open it to the page I bookmarked earlier. It's the one numbered for age 11, when I first began to keep my journals, and I lay it open on the mattress. Then the next bookmarked journal, age 12, and 13. I repeat the process until there's a blanket of drawings across the surface of my bed, all of the same image, the last being from this morning. Rolling hills of green as far as the eye can see. The same hills and waist-high stalks I've dreamt of my entire life. An answer to why I left and where I'm going. Home. I feel more than hear Aker's deep intake of breath. Taking in one last look at the place I found solace in most of my life, I open the door. The crossways are empty, but the sounds of congregating voices and instruments float up from below. It's dusk, and the lanterns are alight along the way. A strong breeze whips errant strands of hair from my braid. Stay behind me, I instruct. Not that there's any way to hide Aker's stature. He's at complete odds with traditional Alaha features. Dark hair instead of light, brown eyes instead of gray. The Kenta clothes he scrubbed and dried to a semblance of cleanliness don't help either. We've taken all of 2 steps past Grenadine's when her raspy, ancient voice stops us dead in our tracks. Where are you sneaking off to? She's leaning against her open door, an all-knowing and delighted smile on her wrinkled lips. I do my best to appear unfazed by her appearance, avoiding her question. Why aren't you at the matching ceremony?
Ah, she waves a hand. There's no good food this year, so what's the point?
Her eyes go to Acre, then come back to me.
He's very handsome. I can see why you're jumping ship.
Wary of saying anything to piss her off, I don't correct her, biting my tongue. Instead, I reach into my pocket and retrieve one of the smaller coins, then two more after thinking about it, and hold them out to her. Her smile grows, stained teeth showing.
You've always known how to speak to my heart.
She takes the 3 gold coins and winks at me.
I'm looking forward to a good night's sleep without you two bickering nonstop.
And with that, she shuts the door in our faces. Iker lifts a brow at me.
I told you to yell at me quieter.
We continue to the nearest cross section, and I go first, hanging and dropping down onto the crosswalk of the story below. Iker follows close behind. We make it to the next story before we see a group of people who are running late for the ceremony, and we lie on our stomachs so they can't see us when they pass below. It sounds like the party is in full swing by the time we reach the 3rd story. We're officially on borrowed time. We'll jump from here. He eyes the choppy water below, probably remembering the swim through the swells of the storm during his escape. We'll climb onto the underbelly of the main and climb that way until we're closer to the dock. I motion for him to hand over the pack, which I secure around my waist. Keep your legs and arms in line with your body, and point your toes. He doesn't voice any objections, if he has them, nodding in response to my instructions. I jump first and tread water while he leaps, a perfect student as he drops neatly into the water before quickly reappearing again. We swim for the ladder and pull ourselves onto the crossbeams below the main. The first time I crossed the underside of the main, it took me hours, but I figured out an efficient method to step across the barnacles and moss-covered beams. We zigzag toward the boats, quiet as we concentrate on our steps. We're almost there, I tell him. The wharf comes into view, the dock in the dead center of the main and directly below the ceremony. I stop Acre with a hand and signal that it's time to jump. The music and chatter cover the sound of our bodies hitting the water. Acre pulls himself onto the dock first, arms outstretched to lift me out, before he leaps onto the nearest fishing boat. Untying my pack, I throw it to him and bend down to undo the mooring line, hands shaking. The sound of dancing feet and music is almost loud enough to block out the pounding of my heart. I'm busy looking down when Acre calls my name. A warning I'm not able to heed quickly enough. Then, hands are on me, the sharp edge of a sword at my neck. Acre lifts his arms in surrender.
Easy,
he says, eyes locked on the mammoth of a man behind me.
Don't move.
Chills skate down my spine at the realization that I'm in Dupree's hands. He instructs someone out of my view to go get Kai.
Onto the dock,
he orders Acre. Acre follows the instructions, hands remaining high for everyone to see, stepping over the side of the hull and onto the planks. Dupree takes a step back, forcing me onto my tiptoes to avoid being cut by his blade. Acre's eyes focus on my exposed throat.
Easy,
he repeats, a deeper warning in his tone. Kai steps into view.
Or what?
2 guards follow along behind him. He looks me over, disappointment and resignation in his gaze, before tilting a chin at Dupree.
At ease.
Dupree lowers the sword, and I suck in a deep breath of relief. It doesn't last long. I can hear the power of Kai's gift lacing the words when he says,
"On your knees."
Acre lowers himself to one knee, then the other, eyes raging despite his calm movements. It's the first time I've seen Kai actively use his gift on someone else, and a newfound fear takes root inside me. The 2 guards close in, placing shackles around Acre's wrists. All the while, his stare doesn't leave Kai, rage simmering under the surface. With Acre momentarily taken care of, Kai runs his hands through his hair, before placing them on his hips as he turns his attention toward me. Sorrow and anger flit across his face, like he's torn between the 2.
Everything I've done to protect you.
Protect me?
I choke out.
You're who I need protecting from. He shakes his head. You have no idea.
I all but snarl at him. Enlighten me, then.
His voice comes out low and cold, eyes despondent. It was me or my father.
Stunned by his words, I stumble back into Dupree. Kai reaches out to steady me, but I jerk away from his touch. Irritation sparks in his eyes.
I could sense your magic reacting to mine in the dress shop.
Why didn't you stop me then?
Because I was hoping I was wrong. He throws a hand up in defeat. I never wanted you to find out like this.
I sneer. Let's not pretend you ever had any intention of telling me.
I did, he argues. I didn't know when or how, but I knew a day would come when I'd have to be honest with you.
Yet here we are. He reaches for me again, stopping short when I tense.
Brynn,
he pleads. There's a long moment as I swallow past the sorrow in my throat, the urge to cry forcing me to keep my mouth shut. When I don't respond, he says it again.
Brynn. That's not her name.
All heads swivel to Aker, whose words were spoken with an eerie calmness. It's unsettling enough to give the men pause, but Aker's attention doesn't deviate from Kai, gaze hard and unyielding despite the compromised position he's in.
You have no power here.
Aker smirks with knowing arrogance.
I have more than you.
Kai doesn't take the bait, turning his back in dismissal, but there's a noticeable unease behind his eyes when he sets his sights back on me.
I only ever fed emotions back to you, emotions you were already feeling.
I shake my head. Nothing you say can justify manipulating me for your own gain. Kai's face becomes hardened, anger and indignation tinting his cheeks with red.
Why do you think I never betted you?
Humiliation burns through my veins, pounds hot in my ears. I know at this moment that he's no longer my friend. It still feels like a low blow. Too low.
I wanted it to be your choice. Without the influence of my magic, I wanted you...
He trails off, almost as if he doesn't want to admit what he's about to say.
I wanted you to really love me when you gave yourself to me.
I don't need my magic to know he's being honest. That's the thing, Kai, I say, voice quiet for just him to hear. I did love you. You were my best friend, and you betrayed me. It takes a few heartbeats, but his reaction morphs from agony to stone.
I have a plan in motion, and I can't let you leave.
Holding my gaze, Kai keeps his back to Aker when he says,
kill him.
I lunge for Kai, but my legs are kicked out from behind me and I land on my knees. One of the guards grabs Aker's hair, angling his head back to expose his throat, while the other draws a sword from his belt. Aker's gaze slides to me, eyes hooded, neck tight from the unnatural angle his head is forced into. There's a breath of time where he holds my stare, almost as if he's wanting to convey something to me. Something like regret, maybe? Then he moves. Swinging the chains from his shackles over his head, he catches the guard behind him by the neck, twisting the metal into a noose. He finishes him off within moments, shackles breaking from his wrists with a flourish of his magic. The other guard lunges for him but stops mid-attack. The sword is now in Aker's hand, and he plunges it deep into the guard's chest. Stunned, the guard stumbles back, gargling on the blood filling his lungs. Dupree tightens his grip on the sword at my neck as Aker's attention turns toward us.
You won't kill her.
He's not the slightest bit winded as he stalks forward. Kai unsheathes the sword at his hip. Aker has the audacity to smirk, not missing a beat as he kicks off a dock post and springs into the air before bringing down a fist right into Kai's face. The fight is over before it starts. Kai falls to the dock with a heavy thud. Dupree pushes the blade up under my chin to urge me into standing, using me as a shield against Aker. Picking up Kai's fallen sword, Aker tests its weight, casually inspecting the weapon as he talks.
Let the girl go, and I'll consider not killing you.
I've perhaps heard less than 5 sentences from Ren's most trusted guard, but this is definitely the first time I've heard him swear.
Go fuck yourself.
Aker looks up from the blade.
I'm starting to think the Alaha are all inbred. It's the only explanation for your level of stupidity.
There's a surprising shake in Dupree's hands, and I hiss against the sting of the blade as it nicks me. Aker goes stock still, losing every stitch of humor.
I'm not scared of you.
In one singular motion, Aker spins and launches the sword like a discus. I squeal, squeezing my eyes shut as the weapon hurtles toward me. The sound of metal cutting through flesh and bone reverberates in my ear. Blood sprays over the top of my head. The sword at my neck slowly slides away as Dupree's large body falls backwards with a loud thump. Aker grabs me by the shoulders.
Are you okay?
I squint up at him. Yeah. He tries to wipe away the blood dripping into my face before rubbing his hand clean against the leg of his pants.
I'm sorry.
I let out a deep breath, trying and failing to stop the shake in my hands and voice. We'll call it even. He sputters out a choked laugh, a smile pulling at the side of his mouth, but then he's gone, deflecting the incoming blade in the nick of time. It misses the intended target, Aker's gut, but Kai's still able to bury the blade halfway into Aker's side before ripping it free. Blood blooms from the spot. Kai jabs with the blade again, but Aker stops it with embarrassing ease by grabbing Kai's wrist. He uses his other hand to grab Kai by the throat, an eerie calm settling over him as he takes the blade and points it at the hollow of Kai's throat. Don't kill him! Kai's gaze swings to me as I approach, but I'm not looking at him. I place a hand on Aker's shoulder. Aker. It's the first time I've called him by his name, and he's slow to turn his head away from Kai, eyes void of any emotion as he meets my gaze. I swallow my fear, knowing this is a big ask considering Kai just tried to kill him. Please, I beg. Taking in a deep breath, life slowly coming back to his eyes, he pulls the sharp point away from Kai's neck. Kai's relief is short-lived as Aker jerks him close, wrapping his forearm around Kai's neck and cutting off his air. Kai fights, but Aker maintains his hold until Kai's face turns a nasty shade of red, then white, before his eyes fall closed. Aker drops Kai unceremoniously to the dock. Thank you, I tell him, but he isn't interested in my gratitude. He inspects Kai's dagger before lifting his shirt to stow it in his waistband. I only get a glimpse of the fresh cut in his side before he covers it again. My pulse finally slows enough for the sound of music to register in my ears again. It seems the same happens for Aker because we both burst into motion simultaneously. I finish untying the boat from the dock and Aker retrieves the paddles, handing me one as we push off, Aker stowing our supplies under the bow seat while I navigate us away from the dock. A flurry of motion catches my eye, and I spot the guard with chains around his neck stumbling to his feet. I thought you killed him, I say to Aker, getting his attention. The guard shoots us a murderous glare as he turns to the stairs leading to the main. Standing, Aker slides Kai's dagger back into his hand. He adjusts his grip on the weapon, then slings it toward the guard. There's a discernible zip as it cuts through the air, followed by an abrupt smacking sound when it slices into the back of the guard's head. Teetering on a middle step, the guard spins in place, giving us a view of the blade's tip projecting from an eye socket. He wobbles around completely before falling down the remaining flight of stairs, landing face down. Aker clicks his tongue against his teeth, stretching out his arm.
Aim is off.
I watch in astonished horror as the dagger dislodges itself from the dead guard and flies back toward Aker. He grunts when it smacks into his palm, as if the retrieval taxed him, and wipes the weapon clean on his pant leg. Neither of us speak as we each grab an oar and begin to row the boat out from under the grove. The light of the main is bright on the water, and we work overtime to move into the shadows. Music chases us for miles and miles as we row into the night. Chapter 16. We are well and truly off course and utterly fucked. We had to abandon our flight northward when they sent the entirety of Alaha's armada after us. White sails littered the horizon in our wake, so we had to make an abrupt turn west, a direction to nowhere. We rowed and rowed and rowed. When we were unable to row anymore, we rowed some more, unable to raise the sails out of fear we'd be too visible, too easily spotted against the dark water. A clatter jerks me out of my mindless rowing. Akers' oar hits the deck a split second before he retches over the side. I move toward him, but my legs give out, so I crawl across the deck to my bag to retrieve my water skin. I hold the skin to his lips. Drink. He's pale and drenched in sweat, eyes closed as his head lolls against the side of the boat. He groans, but manages to tip his head back far enough to take a few swallows. Let me see your side. He groans again when he moves to give me access. His shirt is soaked with blood and sweat. The gash is wet, bright red seeping through the cracked, dried blood around the wound. I need to clean it. Don't move. He manages to speak.
Wasn't going anywhere.
I get my feet underneath me and wobble to the hatch where the emergency medicine kit is kept. While gathering the clean dressings and a tin of salve, I'm grateful to find an extra skin of water, left by someone at the end of their last excursion. I bring everything to Aker and settle on my knees at his side. This is going to hurt, I tell him, uncapping the water.
Wait.
He tries to sit up and blood gushes from the wound, more blood than he can afford to lose.
Whoa! I told you not to move!
I place a hand on his shoulder to stop him.
You...
He wheezes, eyes cracking open to look at me as he reaches for the water in my hand.
You drink.
After I clean your wound. He attempts to sit up again, abdominals clenching from the effort.
Okay, okay.
I maintain a firm hand on him to ensure he doesn't move any further while I bring the water to my mouth with the other. My lips are cracked, and water dribbles out of my mouth, but I find myself taking large gulps when I mean to take only a few sips. Aker finds a way to look smug even when he's half dying from blood loss. I don't bother warning him when I tip the rest of the contents on the cut and reach into the med kit for some salve. Dang rabbits. Upon opening the pot, I discover it's empty but for a smidge coated along the rim. I gather as much as I can and pack it into the open wound. He sucks in a hiss of breath, but the little bit of medicine seems to be just enough to staunch the blood flow. I make him drink the rest of the water from the second skin while I wait for the wound to clot. We need to wrap it, I tell him. He's able to keep his eyes open for longer than a few seconds.
I'll heal much faster on land.
Every word out of his mouth is coarse around the edges. It's going to be a while before we see land.
My people have been waiting, keeping their ships moored out of sight,
he says.
If we're lucky, we might run into them.
I don't voice my doubts. We went west because it's the least likely of the paths we could have taken, and it's the least likely place anyone will look for us, whether Alaha or Kenta. I place the gauze against the wound, using my other hand to bring the length of wrap around his waist. My nose is inches away from his abdomen as I reach behind him to tie the bandage, ignoring his gritted teeth when I tighten it and secure the ends. I look up at him. It had to be done. He tries and loses the battle to remain focused on me, so I help him lie on the deck, where he passes out in an instant. The sky is gray, the rising sun within an hour of cresting the horizon, and when I push to stand, my knees shake. Hell, I might pass out. It takes all my remaining strength to get the headsail off the front mast. I stretch the oars across the width of the hull and secure them as best I can with some spare rope before I drape the sail over it, creating a makeshift canopy for shade. There's just enough room for me to lie on my side next to him, and I finally allow the exhaustion to win out. Chapter 17. The sound of low, rolling thunder pulls me awake. The boat rocks with the roll of the swell, but Aker still sleeps beside me. I check his breathing with a palm on his chest and am relieved to see more color in his cheeks. I climb out from under the sail and spot black clouds hovering ominously in the distance. The weather vane atop the mast swings occasionally, but the wind is mostly steady. The storm is far enough away to not be a threat. It's difficult to figure out how far we've drifted off course with clouds blocking the earliest stars coming out in the darkening sky. The boat is meant to be manned by two, but it's possible with one if they're experienced enough.
Although all guard trainees are given sailing lessons starting at 13, I'm not an expert, but I've helped take a sailboat out to fish enough times to get by. I ransack the fishing supplies. There are poles and lines and a variety of tackles for attracting different kinds of fish, bobbers and hooks and weights, which will come in handy, but we're really in a need of system to catch drinking water. Finding what I'm after, I use my blade to cut an individual length of rope from the fishing net and unbraid it from the woven pattern. Once I get a long, single strand, I tie it around the mast and stretch it to one of the live wells in the hull. Rain will hit the mast, then the line, and run along it down into the well, a basin for drinking water. Thunder echoes over the water, and it must wake Acre up, because a loud thump sounds, followed by a colorful array of curse words. I pull back the makeshift shade cover. "Good morning, sunshine." He leans on an elbow, squinting up at me before taking in the darkening sky and the agitated sea around us.
"How long have I been out?"
I shrug. "Your guess is as good as mine. I woke up not long ago."
"You've been busy,"
he says, noticing the supplies I've dragged out. I step closer and kneel beside him. "How do you feel?" Without me having to ask, he lifts his stained shirt to reveal his dressing. I prod it a little, satisfied by how well it slowed the blood flow. Lightning flashes on the horizon.
"How worried should we be about that?"
he says, nodding toward the monstrosity of a storm, thankfully still miles away. "Not very," I tell him, pulling his shirt back down. "But we should use the gust front to our advantage. We've been drifting for a while."
"A very long while."
He sits up before wobbling to his feet.
"Tell me what to do."
He's either masking it very well, or the salve is working miracles, because there's not a trace of pain on his face. I'm suspicious, but I can't put the head sail back up without his help. Working together, we roll the sail back into position. I demonstrate how to tie it back to the bow, then to the mast, knowing we'll be repeating this job often. With a lot of tugging and pulling and cursing on both of our parts, we're able to get the jib in place. Then I climb the mast to hoist the canvas into place. The weather vane begins to spin as the wind shifts direction. "That's good," I tell Acre, handing him the halyard for the mainsail. "Pull this while I steer." Sitting with my back to the stern, I keep a hand on the tiller as Acre heaves on the rope, pulling the mainsail up with each downward motion. Then we're moving, cutting through the water as the sail balloons. I point to the standing end, a handle on the deck. "Tie the rope there." He repeats the knot I taught him during an earlier break from incessant rowing, and I smile, impressed by how quick he's picked up on it. "Get down. I'm going to swing the boom." Acre sits on the opposite side of the cockpit, facing me, legs wedged against mine. I shift the rudder, and the boom swings to the side, sending the boat into a heel. Water kisses the top of the hull as we turn. I keep my eye on the compass in the sails, finding the perfect combination of wind and direction. With the bow turned northeast, the boat loses some of its pitch, and we're cruising at a decent speed. Closing my eyes, I allow myself to bask in the wind as it whips past my face. I'm doing it. I'm going to put my feet on solid ground. At least, if we make it. There have been deserters before, but there's no telling if they ever saw land. Kenta is a long way to travel in a small fishing boat, but it's the only option we have. When I open my eyes, Acre is staring at me. "What?" The word escapes my mouth like a barb, more than a question. A small smile flares across his face, gone as quick as it appeared.
"I'm impressed. That's all."
I'm ashamed of the blush trying to flood my cheeks. The solitude of the boat and the vast sea make it all the more difficult to withstand the intensity of his attention. "So easily fooled, are you?" He scrunches his nose, playfulness in his expression.
"I heard the guards talking about Kai's future wife being surprisingly good with a sword."
I cringe. "Don't be so sure about that. I'm nothing compared to you."
"Is that a compliment?"
"No." He laughs. After a moment, I say, "If you could fight like that all along, why didn't you just escape?" He shifts his head from side to side.
"I could have, but I needed to understand how integrated you were, find out how deep Kai's hold went, and I needed you to trust me.
It's presumptuous of him to assume I trust him now, but he's got a fair point. I got in this boat with him despite watching him take down 4 highly trained, armed men by himself. I'm either stupid or desperate. Maybe a little of both. You fight like you've been to battle. My assertion causes a shift in his demeanor. It's slight, almost unnoticeable, but definitely there just behind the eyes.
I joined the army when I turned 13, and I saw my first battle that very same year.
The image of a young, wiry boy with dark hair fighting against grown men makes my stomach turn. Only desperation teaches soldiers how to kill with the type of savagery he had displayed. There was no hesitation when he killed the Alaha guards, and there was no hesitation in his eyes when he was about to kill Kai. Why? Were Kenta so desperate for warm bodies that they'd sacrifice their youngest? He doesn't react to my blatant distaste for sending children to war.
The people you saw at the market weren't an honest portrayal of how our people have fared. We've been in and out of conflict with a neighboring territory for decades. It's not uncommon for kids to join the service young, to begin training in adolescence. My friend joined, so I went as well.
I struggle to contain my disdain. According to what you told me before, all war and conflict should have ended when you exiled Ren. A flicker of anger sparks in his eyes.
It did. For 100 years we lived in peace. It wasn't until your abduction that things fell apart.
My voice is laced with sarcasm when I reply. Oh, well, in that case, my apologies for getting myself kidnapped.
Are you always this difficult?
He asks. Only when I abandon everything and everyone I've ever known to venture to a new land that is apparently riddled with conflict. And I'm stuck on a boat with just you, it seems. There's a tick in his jaw as he looks out over the water, gaze pensive.
Osiris, the leader of Roysen, admitted to taking you and your mother killed him.
But, as we now both know, he did not.
I haven't figured out why he would have confessed to something he didn't do,
he says.
Knowing the outcome would mean his death. When his brother Chris inherited the throne, he reignited the call for a revolution. He was a secret sympathizer of Ren's during war against Alaha. We've been battling on and off ever since.
There's a period of time where there's nothing but the sound of the waves beneath the boat and the catch of the sails. We spend the majority of the night in our own thoughts, in our own tiny spaces on our respective sides of the deck. When a rogue wave causes the boat to dip, he winces in pain. I tie off the tiller so the rudder remains in position and gather the bandage supplies, folding myself into the space next to him. He lifts his shirt without question. His side is coated in sticky blood, a mixture of old and new. Why didn't you say anything? I attempt to pull away the gauze, and he sucks air in through his teeth.
Oh, I have no idea,
he says, voice laced with pain and sarcasm. I smile. I can't help it. I reach for my blade, and he goes still as I maneuver the tip underneath the bandage, slicing with a swift motion to cut the fabric away from his body. Fresh blood drips from the wound. It needs sutures. He nods, like he already suspected as much. I retrieve what I'll need from the fishing supplies, a line and a hook, whatever salve I can find. I begin to shut the hatch when a dark bottle rolls out from under the hull, knocking against the wood. Smiling, I hold it in the air as I look at him. Look what I found. He holds out his hand for me to give it to him. He uncorks the bottle and brings it to his nose, making a face of abject horror.
Are you trying to kill me?
Mead is considered contraband in Alaha, so there's no telling how long it's been hidden in there. He gives it one last sniff before taking a swig, face contorting as he swallows. Then he lifts the shirt clean from his body and pours the liquid right over his stab wound. He groans through his teeth, veins popping out of his neck and chest as he clenches up, waiting for the burning to pass, releasing a sharp breath of relief when it does. He lies flat on his back, looking up at me as I cut the excess line off the hook with my blade.
Do your worst.
My eyes pause on a V-shaped scar below his ribcage. I redirect my attention to the fresh wound and bring the hook down to the top of the gash.
I'll see what I can manage.
He huffs out a small laugh, but it's cut short when the tip of the hook sinks into his flesh. His stomach goes taut as I press hard enough to get the hook back through the other side. One down. He releases a breath and says,
"Tell me about your childhood."
I can feel more than see his eyes on me as I tie the line into a knot, readying another stitch. What do you want to know?
What was it like?
Realizing he needs a distraction, I tell him. I describe living with the captain and Fallon for the first few years. They treated me the same as Kai. The same schooling, the same chores. We spent summers swimming and fishing and playing hide-and-seek across the entire grove. Then I tell him about the trouble we got into, the stealing and pranks and overall havoc we caused as preteens, so disruptive that we had to be separated. I was given my own shiel, located at the top of the grove with the other parentless and unmatched individuals. It did a number on me at first. No one my age wanted to be seen hanging with the kid who lived on Urchin Row. It was lonely, but I grew accustomed to the solitude. Once I was old enough to try out for the guards, it gave me a sense of purpose. I lived to train and formed friendships with Messer and Aurora. Or, looking back, I realize I became friends with Messer and Aurora tolerated me. Which shouldn't be discounted because Aurora tolerates no one. If there's anything to be said about the hardships of Alaha, it's simply that I was always on the outside looking in. Whether it was my lack of familial connections and a community built upon favoritism, or my unusual copper hair, I just never quite fit in. Tying the last stitch, I look up at Aker. He inspects my work and must deem it satisfactory because he sits up so I can redress it. After I'm done, he places his hand over mine, stopping me from pulling away.
I spent years hoping you died that day. The alternative only left space for me to imagine the worst things happening to you. I'm glad you have good memories there, even if I wish they could have been of your true home instead.
There seems to be more he wants to say, but he releases me. My childhood wasn't perfect, but I've known peace living in Alaha. It's more than he can say for himself. There's something that's been bothering me, though. Why did you make me put my hand on the stone wall?
I knew if Alaha kept you away this entire time, you missed your awakening.
What do you mean, awakening?
When someone comes into their magic. I knew the only way I could be sure it was you was to get you to touch the land.
You knew it would hurt.
Yes,
he says, looking apologetic.
That's why I followed you. I told myself it wasn't possible. It was stupid of Ren to allow you to return, and I couldn't let you go without being sure.
I realize my hand is still against his side, under his own, when I feel the shift of his muscles under my palm. Self-conscious, I pull my hand back, and he follows the movement with his eyes, but he doesn't draw attention to it. Why does it hurt? The awakening.
It's like growing pains hurt during adolescence. You just weren't introduced to it gradually over time, so you got the full dose all at once.
So this is it. My magic, I say, tossing the blade into my other hand. The power to call a single blade.
No.
He smiles, shaking his head.
That's child's play. Your true gifts won't be revealed until you finish the awakening.
My stomach falls. You mean what I felt at the market wasn't it? He shakes his head.
I've only heard stories of people who've experienced a late-in-life awakening, and from what I've been told, it's painful, but over within a day or so.
I jab the knife into the deck of the boat. Let me get this straight. You're leading me to land, where I'm going to have to experience the worst pain I've ever felt for an undetermined amount of time? He makes a face.
More or less.
Clenching my teeth, I call the blade into my outstretched hand. It zips the short distance into my palm. It better be a damn spectacular gift.
I have a feeling it will be.
After checking the compass to make sure we're still headed in the right direction, I return to the stern. It's quiet for a long time. Hours, it feels like. Both of us lost to our thoughts and the pull of the sea. Then something occurs to me. So you're telling me if I whittle a spoon from the hearthstone, I say, eyes narrowed on him, and I use said spoon to gouge a man's eyes out, I'll be able to call it back to me? He rolls his eyes, but a smile begins to form at the corners of his mouth.
I guess it depends on if you whittled the spoon with the specific intent to gouge people's eyes out with it.
I'm contemplating what other weapons I could create from everyday objects when I feel Aker's eyes on me.
For what it's worth,
he says, face lined with regret.
I am sorry.
I give him a curious look.
For Kai, and leaving the only home you've ever known.
I take a deep breath and let it out slowly. His apology isn't worth anything, really, but it's a nice sentiment anyway. I shrug. Me too. Chapter 18. Aker snaps the fishing line with his teeth as he continues to set the hooks at the end of the rods. We took turns keeping watch last night. First him, then me, and he woke up hungry. We're both thirsty, but neither of us voice it, knowing it's wasted breath. The fishing gear is meant for catching smaller prey on the reefs east and south of Alaha, but that also feels like a needless fact to point out. They are what we have, and we'll catch what we can. Hopefully. There's not much wind today, so it's slow going. I keep checking the compass and adjusting the tiller, but it's never by much. I can't stop my eyes from drifting back to Aker. His arms and chest are on full display, shirt hanging from the boom to dry after an attempt to scrub the putrid blood from it. My eyes track his hands and fingers as they tie a knot. I blame it on sheer boredom and the lack of anything else to stare at. Who taught you to fish? He bites off the line with an audible snicking of teeth.
My best friend, Hallis, mostly. We'd fish any time we traveled with the army. Freshwater fish from streams, lakes, stuff like that.
I realize I know so little about him, when he seems to know everything about me. Is he the friend you followed when he joined up?
Yeah.
He smiles up at me.
Much to my father's dismay.
This garners my interest. I figured most noblemen would be proud to know their sons wanted to serve.
He'd have preferred I spent my teenage years under his wing, gaining political notoriety at court.
And your mother? He furrows his brow, struggling to get the reel to set on the pole just right.
She died when I was 12.
I'm sorry. He shakes his head, letting me know my apology is unnecessary.
My sister mothers me plenty.
I pretend there's something more interesting to look at on the horizon than his back muscles. And your match?
My match,
he repeats, glancing at me before continuing the task of winding up a reel. Yeah, you said they're rare in Kenta. What's she like?
Well,
he says, shaking his head with a smile,
she's stunning.
The way he says it makes it undeniable, like he means it with every fiber of his being. I can't control my eye roll. Yeah, I got that with all the waxing lyrical about her eyes. Tell me about her. What's she like? What does she do? He scratches his chin, about to speak when he notices something over my shoulder, eyes growing round at what he sees. I hear the flapping of wings before I turn in time to see a midnight-colored bird land on the stern of the boat. He squawks, and I gasp, a smile overtaking my face. How did you find me? As soon as the question is out of my mouth, Aker is pulling me back with an arm around my waist. Hey! I kick my feet in protest. What are you doing? He pulls me as far as he can from the bird and shields my body with his, reaching for his dagger. Having seen how lightning fast his reflexes are, I do the only thing I can think of. I tackle him. He lands on the deck with an audible oof.
What are you doing?
I don't care how hungry you are, I yell. You're not eating my bird.
What?
He looks over his shoulder, not quite meeting my eyes from his prone position.
I'm not going to eat it. I want to kill it.
So you can eat it. I keep my body weight securely on his back.
It's more likely to eat me.
You... What? I look up at the bird, and he's watching us. Head tilted to the side with a sense of keen understanding. He scratches his head with a tiny talon, leaving a single feather askew. Acre groans underneath me.
You do realize I could easily overpower you if I wanted to, right?
Promise you won't kill my bird? We both watch as the bird spots a wood ant by its feet. He pecks at it, chasing it along the edge of the hull. Acre rolls his eyes with a groan.
I promise.
I'm slow to rise, and Acre is just as cautious, eyes trained on the bird as it hops across the gunwale. Calm down. He's harmless. I step around Acre and hold out my hand for the bird to hop onto my wrist. He tucks his head in and rubs it in my palm, begging for scratches. Acre shifts closer, taking only the tiniest of steps.
And how, may I ask, did you gain an Ian as a pet?
He says, like the term of endearment hurts him to say. He flew through my window, or fell, more like it. His wing was injured, and I nursed him back to health. He flips over my wrist and dangles. Wait, what's an Ian?
They're mythological creatures. Birds of prey that can devour men whole without leaving a trace. And I've seen more than enough illustrations to know that that,
he points accusingly at the bird,
is an Ian.
Curious, I say, eyeing the water around the boat. Sounds an awful lot like the stories of the giant squid we have in Alaha.
There are also tales of demon creatures that supposedly scoured the earth millennia ago.
The bird's talons tighten around my wrist, the only warning I have before he takes flight. Acre ducks as he flies over his head to land on top of the mast. Grenadine was a hag to him, and the bird never tried to eat her.
I am definitely a more tempting meal than Grenadine,
he says, some of his playfulness returning. He takes one last look at the animal before checking the fishing rods.
What's his name?
We weren't allowed pets in Alaha, so I never gave him one. I don't even know if he's a he. Acre looks at me, then the bird.
Well, it looks like he's gotten attached to you regardless.
I think about it for a second, marveling at the bird who flew across an ocean to find me. Blue, I say. I like the name Blue. He taps the lines, checking for tension.
Blue it is.
He smirks, about to say something smart, no doubt, when one of the rods across from us begins to curve. He rushes to the other side of the boat and jerks the pole out of its holder, rapidly reeling in the spool. I reach for the line and tug, excited by the decent-sized pomperfish that breaks the surface of the water. We work in tandem to get the fish close enough to the boat for me to fully lift it out of the water and over the side of the hull. It flops at our feet. Acre pinches it by the mouth and removes the hook, holding it up to show it off, his smile stretching from ear to ear. A loud screech comes from above. Our heads jerk back in perfect time to miss the bird's, Blue's, incoming talons as he snatches the fish from Acre's grasp in one fell swoop. He lands on the stern and, in the span of a few seconds, stretches his beak open to the point of distorting the rest of his body, fitting the entire fish into his gaping maw before swallowing it whole. Acre and I glance at each other in shock, mouths hanging open. I look back at the bird, afraid to take my eyes off of him. How did he fit all of it in there? He shakes his head, as disbelieving as I am.
Magic.
We meet eyes again, and Acre points a finger at me.
Keep it away from me.
He swings his finger in the bird's direction.
And keep away from my food.
Blue squawks. I crouch low in front of him. You must have been hungry after flying all this way. He stares back, eyes black as obsidian, holding mine. I'll make you a deal. We'll save a portion of food for you as long as you don't steal our catches. I narrow my eyes at him, hoping we've reached a new understanding. And you can't eat Acre either. I tack on for good measure. I don't know if it's actually possible for Blue to eat a man whole, but I don't want to take any chances. He clicks his beak in rapid succession, and I'm going to assume that means he's in agreement. Chapter 19. Thirsty doesn't begin to describe it. It doesn't matter how often I lick my lips or how often I swallow. There's no reprieve for the split skin and scratchy throat. We would be in worse shape without food and the little hydration we've received from the raw meat of the fish we caught over the last couple of days. Edgar hasn't said much, but neither have I guess. It's hard to think of anything other than thirst and the desire to reach our destination. There's been near constant cloud cover, day and night. It's a nice break from the heat of the sun during the day, but we also haven't been able to pinpoint our location at night. Blue flies overhead, wings outstretched on the wind. We've remained steadfast in our progress north, switching shifts to keep an eye on the sails and for any possible ships on the horizon. The days somehow seem to come and go with the slowest torture, yet they've also passed in a blur. So many, I've nearly lost track. We've settled into a rhythm. Wake, eat, sleep, repeat. Acker dozes, the lulling rock of the ship in full effect, and I yawn for what feels like the 100th time. We're moving slow enough for me to take a cooling dip in the water and relieve myself. It'll also give me the chance to check for barnacles that might have attached themselves to the bottom of the boat. If we wait too long, they'll reduce our speed from the weight of the drag. Acker doesn't wake as I strip down to my undergarments, his chest still rising and falling in a steady rhythm. I sit on the side of the boat and tie the mooring line around my waist before slipping overboard. I relish the cool ocean water, like a balm on my overheated skin as I float on my back. After a while, I call my blade and dive underneath the boat. There are a few clusters of barnacles beginning to grow on the stern, which come off easily enough. I keep hold of a handful at a time, feeding them to Blue when I come up for a breath. I repeat the process enough that I lose track of time. It's a nice respite, focusing on something other than how miserable I am. As much as I know leaving Alaha was something I had to do, it doesn't stop me from being homesick. I miss my small shield and my bed and the security of knowing what the day will bring. I miss Kai and Messer, maybe even Aurora, but that's probably the dehydration getting the better of me. I come up to feed Blue. He bobs on top of the water in between feedings,